And now to continue, Paul's still on this. It's a bit easier now. It goes more straightforward. They're asking him, keep the question in mind, is it okay to be a celibate? Verse 1 has got it. Is that okay to do? Okay, well, he's looked at a lot of situations. Then he comes back to fundamental principles. And here he starts in 7:17. However that may be, let each, here it is, here's the principle. Let each of you lead the life the Lord has assigned, to which God called you. Brackets. If you're a priest who went through a seminary and you're trying to live a celibate life, but you're actually sexually all over the place and you're not learning to love and you're hiding in a presbytery and you're finding drink the only way to survive, or horses or something else, but you're not actually loving and you're becoming tighter and tighter and angrier, for God's sake, someone has to say to you, get out of this, because you're not loving and you're not growing in love. It's not for you. You've got these beautiful ideas. Your mum and dad might have wanted you to be a priest. You know, you might have had this, but it was unreal. You can't do it, for God's sake. Get out of it, get yourself together, and be open to a relationship that might help you learn to love in a way that's more normal. You following me? That might be what you've got to do. If you're in a marriage situation, however good the intentions were, and however loving you were, and there's hundreds of reasons for this, but it's actually, you see this beautiful flower, male or female, wilting, dying, becoming angry, dysfunctional, all the rest of it. If anyone loves you, they've got to get you out of that situation, or they've got to water you, or they've got to nurture you, or help you look inside and find what's going wrong and live it. You know, there's all the possibilities. But we can't have just black and white and lock people in. So we've got to do all that. I think Paul's asking that. But the key thing is, find your gift and find someone else's gift. And we all know, I know many very close to me who... they left a marriage and they started to grow and they started to blossom and they started to be loved and they started to love and everybody knows, I don't care who doesn't know, if you just look and you think, oh, thank God, that's beautiful. At last this human being is, you know, freed from whatever dysfunctional pressures pushed him or her in a certain direction. I also know people, which you know, who are in a very difficult marriage, and you meet them and they're just so beautiful. You've just got to say, boy, this is heroic, but it's very beautiful and it's very redemptive, and this person is growing through the pain, but they're growing through it. And we all know people, don't we, who are in situations, they've got to get out of it because they've been crippled by it. And so it goes on and on and on. And our general principles can be very fine, and we've got to keep... But our basic principle of Paul is Jesus on the cross, loving in suffering. Suffering isn't good. Loving in it is. That's the key we've got to look for. Is love growing or is love not growing? And we can't always answer that. So he says, look, that's the key thing. This is my rule in all the churches, he says. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? In other words, were you a Jew? Well, don't try and get rid of your circumcision. There were ways of doing it, pretty painful, because you've become a Christian. You don't have to change that. Was anyone at the time of his calling uncircumcised? Well, don't have to seek circumcision, for heaven's sake. That's the circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is nothing. Being 6 foot tall or 5 foot tall is not a big issue. You know, that's not what matters. But obeying the commandments of God, that's what it matters. Yeah, that's everything. Let each of you remain in the condition in which you were called. Well, I hope you see the logic. He's not interested in that subject. He's saying, if you're circumcised, don't change. If you're uncircumcised, don't change. If you're married, don't change. If you're single, don't change. I mean, that's not the key issue. It's finding your gift and learning to love, whatever your situation. Then he gives another example. These can be done quickly because I think they're self-explanatory. What about, were you a slave when you were called into Christianity? Well, don't be concerned about it. Now, this next sentence needs care because it's translated. I don't think the New Revised Standard Version has got a good translation. I think it's missed the point, but it may not have. I'll just offer you two possibilities. All the Greek says is, if, were you a slave when you're called, don't be concerned. If you can gain your freedom, all the Greek says is, avail yourself. If you can gain your freedom, avail yourself. Here are the two opinions. You're a slave. If you can gain freedom, the freedom that comes by being a Christian, grab it. Grab that freedom of being a Christian. But you're still a slave, you get it? But avail yourself of this blessing of your condition that you're in. Live it to the full. Follow me? Another possibility, I think more likely, but who cares what I think in a way, is I'm not saying it's good to be a slave. If you're a slave and the possibility of being freed comes up, grab it. That's all right. I'm not saying you've got to stay a slave for the rest of your life to be a Christian because you were when you started. No, if the opportunity of freedom comes up, and it normally did come up for people, although there was an expectation that you'd be freed by the time you're 30 or something, if you're a soldier at 18, or it was a it depended on your master, but it was very common to be freed. Well, if the opportunity comes up, grab it. I'm not saying stay a slave all your life. I think that's what Paul means. The Greek, I suppose, must be ambiguous, or the New Revised Standard Version translators, who are pretty brilliant people, wouldn't have made a mess of the translation the way they have. But anyhow, I offer you the alternate there. Avail yourself of the opportunity. Depends how you understand the object. Avail yourself of the opportunity, or avail yourself of the condition that you've got of freedom in the church. For whoever was called in the Lord as a slave, well, okay, if you're a slave, you're really free because you belong to the Lord. Just as whoever free are called to be a slave in Christ. Do you get it? It's using the words metaphorically. What matters is your communion with Jesus. You were bought with a price. Don't become slaves of human masters. So don't change if you're free and think you've got to be a slave. Don't think you've got to. In whatever condition you are called, brothers, remain there with God. It's not essentially the key issue. The key issue is communion. And then he turns his attention now to the unmarried. This is important because it's misunderstood too, as a lot of these passages are. Okay, so he's talked about married people who were believers. He talked briefly about celibacy. He then talked about married people, one of whom is not a believer. And now he addresses himself to the unmarried in the community, whether they be widows, widowers, separated people, single people, whatever. And he says, concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord. Here again, I'm not giving you something, I'm just giving you my opinion as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. How else can he say it? I'm giving you my opinion on the matter. I might be wrong. Now, wouldn't we be silly to take this as just as seriously as the other one? He's not giving it as seriously. I think, this is what I think, says Paul, brackets, I might be wrong, but I think that in view of the, this is important, in view of the impending crisis, it's well for you to remain as you are. Okay, now we get back into Paul's mentality. Impending crisis, ananke. That word is used by Jesus. There will be great distress, different translation, same word in Greek, of the earth and wrath against its people. Prophet Zephaniah 1:15 says, that day will be a day of wrath, a day of distress, ananke, and anguish, a day of ruin and devastation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thickness. See, Paul is living in, he's expecting the parousia soon. He's expecting the resurrection soon. Because Jesus is risen, he's the first fruits. Once he's come up, we're all going. So he's expecting an end to the present system of the world. I don't mean the end of the world, but an end of what's going on. He's expecting mass conversion to Christianity, a new heaven, a new earth, a new thing. So, and he thinks it'll happen in his lifetime. He's expecting in earlier passages to be alive when it happens. So granted it's all fairly soon, how would you advise someone if you knew someone, okay, if you knew someone was going to die next weekend, they're dying, and they were talking to you about selling their house, getting rid of the furniture, buying a new house, buying a farm, you'd probably say, look, leave it, will you? I mean, there's more important things to deal with at the moment. You've only got a week to live, for God's sake. Why don't you talk to your kids, or, you know, wouldn't you? Well, now, if you're like Paul and think the end is coming soon, he's saying, well, why get caught up in it? I mean, if you're not married now, well, you know, you've got all this stuff to send out, and you've got to organise all this. Look, just don't go for it. So he's writing within a certain context. Verse 27, which I haven't put there for you, reads, Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Don't seek a wife. So there's more important things to do at the moment, so I'd suggest, my opinion is, stay as you are. But if you marry, you don't sin. It's okay, you're free. You can marry. I'm not saying don't marry, but you don't sin. And if a virgin marries, she doesn't sin. Yet those who marry will experience distress in this life, and I'd spare you that. It's not going to be a bed of roses, says Paul. There's difficulties involved, as all everybody knows. It's a big thing to be taking on, you know. In other words, I wish you were like me. I think it'd be simpler to be celibate, but you go for it. I mean, brothers and sisters, the appointed time has grown short. See the logic? The present form of the world is passing away. These are not ultimately what matters, so focus on something richer. From now on, let even those who have wives be as though they had none. Those who mourn as though they were not mourning. Those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing. Those who buy as though they had no possessions. Those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. This is hyperbole. It's obviously spinning off these things. He's trying to say, get your perspectives in order. These are not the final things that matter. What really matters is communion with Jesus, etc. So he's just focusing. For the present form of the world is passing away. And now verse 32 to 35. I want you to be free from anxiety. Problem here in the Greek. The Greek is merimna, and I'll read to you another passage where you're familiar with that occurring. Merimna, but merimna can be used negatively, like being anxious, or merimna can be caring for others, involved in the difficult task of looking after someone. So it can be a positive thing or it can be a negative thing. I guess it depends on your mental attitude. So it's about taking care. We even use that word, don't we, say you can be caring, but care can also mean anxiety too. So it's a little bit the same. So I want you to be free from anxiety. And then he says, this is, the unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord. The married man is anxious about the affairs of the world, how to please his wife. His interests are divided. Needs to be treated with care, and I will in a minute. That's what he says. And then he addresses the women. The unmarried woman and the virgin, so the unmarried woman may be separated or the widow. The unmarried woman and the virgin are anxious about the affairs of the Lord so that they may be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about the affairs of the world. How does she please her husband? She's caught up in the realities of this passing world, necessarily. I say this for your own benefit. I'm not putting a restraint upon you, so he's not giving a firm opinion. I'm just saying it, but to promote good order and, here it is, unhindered devotion to the Lord. The problem with this passage, throughout the use that it's got in the church's dogmas and history and articles, is that people have assumed that unhindered devotion to the Lord applies to the unmarried. And that if you're married, you're hindered. He's not saying that. Please look at it really carefully. He doesn't say it here, but marriage is a sacrament. In fact, if that's the gift you have from God, that's the way you're going to give unhindered devotion to the Lord, by living your gift. He's already said that, so he's not going back on that. But sometimes this is read a bit that way, as though the celibate has unhindered devotion to the Lord, whereas the married person is caught between the two. He's simply making actual statements about what happens when you have marriage, family, kids, education, work, all the rest of it, as distinct from the celibate life, which is a love relationship to you and Jesus, which, now, it can be as divided and all that as everybody else knows. But he's kind of saying, if you're going to take on marriage, know what you're doing. Realize that it's a complex thing with a lot of involvement in it. Now I'll go on to make one of the points I wanted to make in relation to this. The story of Mary and Martha in Luke chapter 10, verse 38 to 42, We see two ways of attending to the Lord, and this parable too is often misused. Martha's problem, you all know the story, I won't go into it with you. Martha's problem was that her way of serving Jesus was not that her way of serving Jesus was itself inferior to that of Mary. Is it better to be praying in the chapel, sitting at Jesus' feet, or cooking? I hope you know the answer to that. The whole of our tradition is the best thing to do is God's will. So if it is God's will for me to be here with you now, it would be a worse thing for me to be at home praying in a chapel, because I'm not doing God's will. I hope that's clear to you. Well, that's the only thing that really matters. Nothing's worse or better than the other. Doing God's will is everything. Doing God's will means loving in the way that community, commitment, all those real things. So there was nothing wrong with what Martha was doing. In fact, when Jesus criticizes her, he says, "Martha, Martha, you are distracted in doing what you're doing." Ah, that's the problem, the distraction. You are anxious, the same word, merimnao. You are troubled. Why can't she help me? Why don't you get Mary to come and help me in the kitchen? And she, if you're going to work in the kitchen, work in the kitchen. Enjoy it. Do it. Love it. Go for it. Beautiful. But if you're all the time thinking, yeah, well, I'm the only one here and the other one, that was her problem. Mary, she's chosen the better part because she's attending, Luke's writing it, of course, she's giving her full attention, undivided devotion to the Lord. Martha could have been doing it too, but she wasn't. That's her problem. Every moment of our life can be a prayer. No activity, no involvement need distract us from God, who is at the heart of everything and who loves us and calls us to himself. Every occupation, and in a most wonderful way, marriage and family life can be a sacrament of love. In fact, marriage is a sacrament of love. As, this would be my offering, as like Martha, we are busy carrying out the mission that God has given us in and for the world, let us remember, like Mary, to sit at the Lord's feet and listen to him. In this way, we may gradually learn, in our silence and in our activity, to give God our unhindered devotion. And now, having gone through all that, Paul, in his attempt, I think it's a brilliant attempt, to be quite honest, he can't say everything, but what he said sounds pretty good to me. He now finally addresses those who are engaged, as in that situation. Betrothed is a better word for their day, and maybe I need to say this too, I will say it really briefly. Engagement as we have it is not quite, well, I guess it changes, but I don't think it's quite the same. Betrothal in Jesus' time, for example, Mary and Joseph were betrothed. Betrothal was the first step in a commitment that there'd have to be terrifically serious reasons to break that. It was agreement between families, as in many cultures today, it was the parents who arranged weddings, and that works pretty well for 90% of our world population. I don't know that we've got a better system, but anyhow, whatever the system, that's how it was. And the families would exchange gifts, and the man and the woman would be betrothed. Once the betrothal took place, then they would not see each other for a year. They would separate. He would live his life, she would live hers. He would be working to get the home together, because he knew now that he was going to be married, it was all firm. He would then work for that, he'd make sure this, he'd get the thing together, and the families would all help and build the house and get everything organised. She'd be there, and her mother saying, "Okay, now you better be serious about this. You've been watching me all my life, little girl, but you're going to have to be a wife, like, next January. So you'll need to do this, and I'll tell you about this." And she'd learn all the thing and learn whatever else she hadn't learned, so that she could then, they could then come. They wouldn't have any sexual relationship in that year. They wouldn't actually be together. But then at the end of the year, they'd come together, and the final gifts would be exchanged, and they would then be married. And they'd go, he would take her to the home. And as, well, we won't go. So that's the situation. So some of them are like that in Corinth. I can't be sure that all the engagement situations in Corinth, what the Gentiles were doing at the time, I'm not over sure. but I'm giving you the Jewish system, and I haven't studied the system, and maybe, and yes, I'll leave it. But something, betrothal was more commitment than engagement might be today. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly towards his fiancée, is our word for it, if his passions are strong and it has to be, well then marry as he wishes. It's no sin, let them marry. It's all right. They've asked, do we have to remain single? Well, they're kind of still single. They're not married, but they're not just single. They're actually engaged. Well, okay, if you find that you need the sexual union to learn to love, if that's how you discern your gift, if you can't be celibate and loving and generative and all that, well, go ahead with your marriage, even though it's next November or January. Okay, stay in that situation. That's fine, says Paul. I think this. There's no sin in getting married, so okay, you don't have to be single. But if someone stands firm in his resolve, being under no necessity, but having his own desire under control and has determined in his own mind to keep her as his fiancée, well, that's okay. And the world might end by Christmas. So if you decide to stay in this friendly relation, whatever it is, but you don't marry, well then you might like to join Paul and go around the world as a missionary or something. It's okay to stay not married. That's all he says. So then, if you marry a fiancée, you're doing well, and if you don't marry, you're doing well. So make up your mind, make your choice, work out what's best for you, find God's gift for you, because you might have become a Christian in the meantime. Pretty complex, but that's what he says. It doesn't sound too unsensible. And then he speaks to the widowed people. And there's probably no one left after he said all this. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives. But if the husband dies, yes, she's free to marry anyone she wishes. But do it in the Lord. Because in the meantime, she's now a Christian. So make your wedding, your marriage now, whatever the first one was, make this one a marriage between believers, a marriage in the Lord, a marriage in faith, you know. Pretty good advice, I would think. But in my judgment, not I'm right, but in my judgment, says Paul, she's more blessed if she remains as she is. And I too think that I have the Spirit of God. And he concludes there his answer to the first question raised in that letter. A very complex answer to a question, and as I hope I've at least made this much aware to you, it's Paul has to be read with utmost care, because we can't exactly locate the situation in Corinth which he was addressing. I've done my best to open up the possibilities, and they were probably pretty complex. So he's answered a situation. To take chapter 7 of the Corinthians, and this is what people do, and take it out of its context, out of answering those situations, and make it a kind of an absolute statement from God that applies to every situation for the rest of the world, is foolish for a start, and not fair to Paul. And if Paul was in our world, he would have written a different chapter 7 to different situations. But the principles underlying it we've got to hold on to. Find your gift. Find other people's gift. Discern it well. Well, all the rest of it is already said, and I'm just keeping you unnecessary to go on with. Learning to love, peace, commitment, fidelity, the Holy Spirit. He says, no, they're probably claiming to have the Spirit, some of they are, some of the people in Corinth, and they're probably coming up with wrong answers on this. And he's just right at the end, he says, hang on, I too have the Spirit, you know, so some things he said really firmly, nearly everything he's given as an opinion, the best he can to respond to their complex question.